fewer days.
We will begin a shortened spring pledge drive on March 29th at 7 a.m. with our second WILL Power Hour.
And you can help make the Power Hour a success by contributing early to the Member Match Fund. Call 217-244-9455 or go online at willpledge.org.
We will use the dollars we raise to challenge others to contribute one day's fundraising in 1 hour, 7 a.m., March 29th.
Thank you.
Focus 580 is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Village, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks for tuning in today. This morning, both hours of Focus 580 come from the archives. So as you listen, keep in mind that today we'll not be taking your calls. Surveys tell us that more than 60% of American households have pets. And indeed, if you ask people, pet owners, about their attitudes toward their companion animals, they routinely describe them as their best friends or as family members. In fact, amazingly enough, even 20% of reptile owners describe their pets as being like a child or family member. And when you ask people, you engage them in conversation about, well, is there any downside to having a pet? The things that they mention are not big veterinary bills, not the kind of damage that their animals might cause in the house, but the inevitable fact that one day their pet will die. This morning in this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about how it is that we became such a nation of animal lovers and about the fact that this is not really a new phenomenon. You can certainly see the roots of contemporary pet ownership going back into the 19th century. And our guest for the program is Catherine Greer. She's the author of a recently published book, which is entitled Pets in America, A History. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press, in which he makes the argument that by looking at this phenomenon, you can actually learn some interesting things about people's ideas about human nature, about responsibility to others, including animals, about child raising. All of that you can see, actually, and learn some things about by studying this very question about why it is that so many people for such a long time in this country have had this very powerful bond with their companion animals. Our guest, Catherine Greer, is professor of material culture studies at the Winterthur Program in Early American Culture at the Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library and the University of Delaware. She's also the author of another book entitled Culture and Comfort, Parlor Making and Middle Class Identity, 1850 to 1930. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Greer, hello.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We'd certainly appreciate it. I know in a little interview here I had read with you, you described yourself as an historian who studies everyday life.
Yes.
Especially the routines and rhythms of life at home. So that would suggest that this kind of subject might be natural. But the thing that I think is interesting is, as you write in the introduction, how studying this phenomenon, pet ownership, gives you a window into a lot of other things that might, at first blush, seem not particularly related. That's
true.
Is really interesting.
It's true, and it interested me the more I got into it. What I discovered is that pet keeping became a lens for looking at a lot of different issues about American society as it developed in the late 18th and the 19th and early 20th centuries. As you mentioned in your introduction, it gives us a window into ideas about what constitutes good character and how to raise children properly. But it also became part of a much wider debate pretty early on in the 19th century about how do you make a good community and what are our responsibilities to others. And the discussion about animal treatment was embedded in a larger discussion that included all kinds of issues like abolitionism and temperance and even an attack on corporal punishment, the idea of corporal punishment. So it became part of a much larger discussion, and I think that's true today. I think that when you talk to people about pet keeping, that it very rapidly becomes a discussion about much broader issues.
It's also interesting that if you think about some of the the characteristics of pet ownership as they exist now in the year 2006, how people think about their animals, how they live with them, what they do with them, stuff they buy for them.
Yes.
that all of that, it's not a recent sort of phenomenon, and certainly it goes back before World War II. It really even goes back before World War I.
Yes.
A lot of the characteristics of modern pet ownership as we think about it start to fall into place really in the as you get into the last quarter or so of the 19th century.
Yes, it's true. And one of the things when I started the project, one of the things about this project that's been so interesting is that every time I've told anybody what I'm working on, one of the things they've had very strong opinions about it, sometimes for or again, but also they've had very strong ideas about when pet keeping started and what people in America started. And what people have said to me over and over is, nobody did this till after World War II when people had more money to spend. And that just didn't make sense to me, because why would suddenly having more disposable income make you want to take an animal into your household? There's not a direct connection that I could see. So I went back into the historical record and discovered, as I got back into diaries and letters and children's books and magazines, that there was quite a lively community of pet keepers early by the 19th century. And then one of the things that happens is, as American society generally starts to become more and more of a consumer society, all these products start to appear for animals. And commercial pet food is a good example of that. Commercially packaged bird seed was the first commercial pet food, and it was offered for sale by the 1840s. And dog food arrived in America via Britain in the 1870s.
And as you go back and you look, you see right back to the spirit we're talking about, people having dogs, people having cats.
Yes.
Caged birds apparently were very, very popular at one time. That seemed to fall off a little, but people
Yes.
kept songbirds and sometimes in very wonderful, elaborate cages that you can still see now preserved as pieces of folk art.
Yes.
So all of that was there in place. People had people kept rabbits. Apparently, that was thought to be things like rabbits and mice were thought to be good children's pets. And even at that time, there was this beginning of this idea that to some extent we still have, that for children, having that kind of interaction with animals, having a pet, is supposed to be a good thing for their healthy development.
Yes, absolutely. And that actually, the first seeds of that appear in John Locke's, the English philosopher John Locke's work in the 1690s, when he describes what he calls keeping favorite animals as a good thing for children as long as they're not allowed to be abusive to them. So that you find evidence of that as early as the 1690s, but what happens by the end, 100 years later, is that parents who are kind of progressive parents and interested in progressive child rearing start to argue that children are these malleable creatures who are not born evil. They have an innate moral sense that needs to be nurtured. And one of the things that you want to do is you want to figure out how to give them responsibility and care for other beings from a very early age. And the best way to practice was to give them pets. So really, by the 1820s and 1830s, a lot of child-rearing advice starts to recommend pet keeping as something that's a positive good, that animals have been around the house before that, but now they're paying attention to them as not just something that's present and not important. It suddenly becomes something that has some real moral implications.
One of the things, just at this point, I wanted to mention, and I have a caller we can get to, something that I think is really wonderful and also tells you something about the way people felt about animals, is that apparently very, very early on in photography, when it got to the point where people had access to photography, that is, they could go someplace and have their picture taken,
yes,
and for not a whole lot of money. What's interesting is that very early on, people started to take their pets. to have their pictures taken. And in the book, there are a number of them, really some really wonderful photographs of either people with their animals or just the animal. They took the animal, they put it on a little chair in front of the camera, and they took their animals, had their animals' photo taken.
It's amazing. I mean, I joke about this and say to people that when photography arrived in America in 1840, 15 minutes after the first studio opened, someone had a dog there. Mm-hmm. It really almost seems like there was latent demand, is that people not only were eager for pictures of themselves, but they were eager for pictures of the things they cared about, and dogs were one. And then as soon as the shutter speed, or excuse me, the camera speed and the film speed improved, especially by the 1850s with the tintype, lots of people could bring in cats as well as dogs. So it's really quite astonishing is that they are bringing these animals into the photo studio. Then by the 1880s, when you start to see the beginnings of real snapshot photography, one of the most popular subjects, just like with family photos today, is the pet, is mm-hmm. having your animal in a photograph, in a snapshot, either with you or by itself, performing tricks or doing the kinds of things it did.
Yeah, they even did memorial photographs, which is something that in the Victorian era people did when they lost a family member.
Yes.
That's something that people now, I think, find a little strange, or some people also find fascinating. The idea is that you, as a memento, if you lost a child or if you lost someone like that, you would have an actual sort of formal portrait taken as a remembrance. And people also did that with their animals. They did that with dogs.
Yes, I have not found dead cat photos yet, but they may be out there. And there are definitely quite a few photos of what we would call posthumous portraits, where a beloved dog has been carried into a photo studio and arranged, and oftentimes the body is arranged so that it doesn't look dead. I mean, they really work hard to make it look like it's just asleep. And the one that I have illustrated in my book is a dog that, you know, you'd have to look closely to make sure that it's actually a dead dog, because they have it arranged as a sleeping dog.
Yeah, this is one of those interesting sort of things, Victorian funerary practices that nowadays we think are sort of strange, but were very common at the time. Our guest in this Point of Focus 580, Catherine Greer, and her book is titled Pets in America, A History. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. And we have a caller here. I will not make them wait any longer. We'll get right to them. Champaign is the place, and that's line number one. Hello.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. As part of your research, I wondered, did you watch or study Errol Morris's first film, The Gates of Heaven?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
I just find it one of the most fascinating examinations of our attitudes about death, but all of it looking from the point of view of this pet cemetery and the people who had their pets buried there, and then even very interesting, the guy whose job was rendering animals to attitudes he had to deal with.
Yes. One of the things I discovered was that, that first of all, the earliest formal burial that I've found of a pet is about in the year 1800. And it's a cat who is discussed in a Philadelphia family as a beloved cat, and they have a formal little funeral for it in their yard. But one of the things that you see is the pet cemetery really comes along as attitudes, people are becoming more and more emotionally invested in pet animals, and because they live in urban places, they no longer have a place where they can bury them. And so the first commercial pet cemetery appears in this country in 1896, and it is still in business today. It's called the Hartsdale Canine Cemetery, and you can visit it in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York, and it's really an extraordinary place. It's full of all kinds of animals, not just dogs. It is a perpetual care cemetery, so that these gravestones, families invest the money, and they often put multiple burials in the same monument, under the same monument, just as people do with family gravestones today.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Others, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly, if you go back to early America, you can find that people had animals in their lives. There was certain people had livestock, obviously, that were raised for food and also to do work. and people had dogs to do all those jobs that dogs do. They're for hunting, I'm sure, for hunting, for herding, for guarding, those traditional roles of dogs. And I'm sure at some point people also would have at least lived with cats or encouraged them to be around because they go after stored grain pests and, you know, that's an important, they actually had an important function there. So people, their attitudes, I would think a lot of their attitudes towards many of these animals would be maybe primarily utilitarian, although I think I would expect that people also would have feelings about them too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sort of wondering, where is there some sort of point, or is it sort of a gray point where you see more of a kind of transition from people's attitudes and experiences mostly being like that, and valuing animals for their function, either for food or for work, to this point where you start to think more about the animal's function as being the kind of companionship that they can provide? And how does it, and there must certainly have been a time when people could have, you know, people had sort of had both those attitudes. I mean,
yeah,
we still do, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people who eat meat and who have companion animals. That's not necessarily mutually exclusive. But, you know, is there some point where you see something interesting in that transition between sort of the one attitude to the other?
Well, one of the things I was struck by was actually it's a more gradual process than I had thought when I started the research. And that people, you know, nowadays we say, well, people have pets because they don't know anything about livestock and, you know, they don't take care of animals for utilitarian reasons. But one of the things that I found out was that people in the past just did both things, that they had no difficulty sort of saying that human purposes were transcendently important. You know, there's a little more ambivalence about that today, at least in some segments of the population. And what they said at the time was, look, you know, man is at the top of this chain of being. It's our responsibility to treat animals well, but in fact, some animals have a function that, you know, we can't live without this function. And so it's our obligation to treat them well prior to the time that we are compelled to use their bodies or treat them well while they do work for us. And it may be that one of the really important transitional points is around the 19-teens and 20s, when the urban workhorse really disappears quickly from cities as automobiles and trucks come along. Because up to that point, even in cities, if you did not have, you know, a cow or chickens, and lots of urban people did, actually, that you saw working animals every day of your life because you saw them. They were they pulled wagons, and they were the light trucks of their day. And that transition away from the urban workhorse happens very quickly. It happens really in the 19-teens and 20s. And at that point, I think for urban people, a really important link with working animals is gone forever. They no longer see them on the streets. They don't see them as workers in their communities. And at that point, I think that because people don't have that ongoing contact with working animals, the way they think about animals generally probably starts to shift a little bit.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the fact that nowadays, if you ask people who have companion animals, and the fact that we use that phrase now tells you something, that they have these animals in their lives. You ask them about them, you see that people do indeed have an important emotional bond,
yes,
and that people do talk about them and think about them as family members. And I think that also there's some evidence to show that there actually can be benefits to having a companion animal around. And, you know, now we have animals that go visiting in nursing homes, and we have animals that go visit sick kids in the hospital. And that seems actually to be very beneficial. Some people, though, I suppose, don't understand that. And some people might, in fact, say they think it's sort of odd that for some people, companion animals could almost function as surrogate children.
Yeah.
What I'm wondering is whether, if you look back, whether you could find people saying those same kinds of things in
oh, yeah,
the past.
Absolutely. One of the things that's so funny about doing this, recovering this sort of this historical discussion about the place of animals, especially companion animals or pets in the household, is that you hear the same arguments for and against over and over and over and over a very long period of time. You'll see people in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, you'll see writers saying, boy, these lap dogs, it's a disgrace the way people carry these little lap dogs around and the way women are foolish over these dogs, and it's a real disgrace. They should be paying attention to running their households and taking care of their children. Well, the discussion that you're hearing right now about the current craze for small lap dogs has some elements that sound very much like that. So one of the difficult and interesting things as a historian is figuring out when you see the same discussion occurring over and over and over periodically in the historic record, what does it mean? And I'm not sure that I have an answer for that exactly. It's that, you know, certain things are different. There's certainly a difference between a 19th century woman with a lap dog and Paris Hilton and her Chihuahua, but you know that the same issues, the same discussions come up repeatedly in the historic record. And I think one of the things it does is it suggests that there is no single answer for this discussion, that there are have been people around for a long time who find contact with animals unpleasant or mysterious, that they don't have sort of a natural, any kind of desire to engage in that. And then you find people in the historical record who are fascinated from the time that they're children. And that, sometimes I think it almost comes down to a matter of temperament. It's sort of hard to say what makes one family like another or different from another in that regard.
Mm. Well, certainly the thing that strikes me is that that the an animal as a fashion accessory is not new, and that people, wealthy people, probably have been doing that for a long time, and then we would get to a point where it also would have been possible for middle class people
to do the same thing,
and maybe indeed that was inspired by the fact that wealthy people did that, and having certain kinds of animals would have been a marker of your status, your social
That's
status.
Very true, especially with purebred dogs. Is that American dogs in most of the 19th century and into the 20th century didn't look, as a population, they didn't look like the population of dogs you see today. There were sort of some basic types, sort of a bulldog type and a terrier type and a spaniel type, but the range of breeds that you see today just did not exist. And what happens when what's called the dog fancy arrives in this country in the last quarter of the 19th century, and it really introduces dogs as status symbols in more significant numbers than ever before. For one thing, you have dogs that, like dachshunds and poodles and things like that, are being imported from Europe, so they have a little bit of cachet that way. And then their rarity, sometimes their fragility, their small size, all the expense involved in obtaining them, all these things kind of add up to the dog as a status symbol, which is something that is well in place by the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Well, that did interest me, that particularly interest in certain kinds of breeds, or the fact that from time to time a particular kind of breed seems to enjoy a lot of popularity.
Yes.
And you see it in illustrations, and people seem to want to have them. That's not new either. That goes back before 1900.
I know, and you find these fads for dogs. In the mid-19th century, there was a fad, although I don't know how many people actually owned them because we don't have good numbers, but there was a fad for Italian greyhounds, those tiny little greyhounds. And then in the 1870s and 80s, there was a fad for pugs, and the pug was an extremely popular and fashionable dog breed to have, and they show up in a lot of photographs. People, once they had a pug, they dressed them up in a fancy collar, and then they took them off to the photographer's studio, and there's some wonderful images of these sort of grumpy-looking pugs. And then there's others that come along. In the early 20th century, the dog that became enormously popular and stayed that way for decades and decades was the Boston Terrier. And what's interesting about that, is that that is an American breed. That dog was, that breed of dog was created in America by crossing a number of different bulldog and terrier types and creating this little spiffy-looking black and white dog whose original function was actually as a fighting dog. And then they breed it down in size, and it really becomes a companion dog. But it was also the object of a fad in the early 20th century.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint. We have some other callers we will get to in just a moment here. As soon as I introduce again the guest, Catherine Greer is professor of material culture studies at the Winterthur Program in Early American Culture, Winterthur Museum, Garden and Library, and the University of Delaware. And she is the author of a very interesting book recently published. It's titled Pets in America, A History, and it's published by the University of North Carolina Press. We have some other folks to talk with here. Next up is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. Mm-hmm. Well, what a great subject, because it's our relationship with animals, especially, as you say, pets, because that word itself implies an emotional attachment versus a practical attachment. About 30 years ago, I was doing a photography shoot out in the country. Taken for weird, I just picked the subject of cows, and this guy was one of the farmers, I guess the farmer owned him, or came by, and he said, hey, I'll call him over. So he yelled something at him, and they all sort of walked over, and they were, you know, licking my hand and stuff. And, and he goes, you know, I said, hey, he said, they seem to know your voice. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, I kind of hate taking them to the slaughterhouse. And I thought, you know, but it was weird because he had this, they would come up and lick his hand and stuff. And, but he almost like he thought of them as not pet. Well, he knew what they were product. But it was just very interesting. I always remember that. I mean, all these years later, I remember that. But, yeah, I was this interesting subject because how people look at pets. I mean, people I know, and I don't have a pet. I haven't had a pet since I left my parents' house. I've never owned one on my own. But it's interesting to see all my friends that have had pets over the years and how they put so much of their emotional energy into them. And, you know, even though they have children and stuff, but, I mean, it's a very, very interesting subject. And
There's a couple things, let me say, in response to that. One of the things that I sometimes hear from people is these people like animals and they don't like people.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that except on sort of the far end where you may have people who are animal hoarders or have a real social pathology of some type, that who says that love is a finite quantity, right, and that there is, you can't have more and more of it to spread around. So what you often find is that pet owners are also people. They really like other people. They love children. That it seems to be part of a sort of a broader embracing of life in all its variety. And so, you know, I've tended to sort of say, now you need to rethink that. Just because people love animals doesn't mean that they don't love people, too.
Yeah, they're not all not PETA people.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's an interesting subject, but, I mean, our relationship with animals is just so fascinating. I just want to say one thing about
Sure.
There was a book written about a 1,000-page book written about the history of the continent of Africa, and the writer, some historian, he covered it from the geological forum. But during the process of that book, he said something very strange. He goes, and these animals, he was talking about cattle and stuff, allowed themselves to be made domestic. And I thought, like as if they said, okay, it's easier for me to work with these people, you know, bipeds or whatever. But I always thought that kind of struck me too as an odd thing. But
I know.
Great subject. I mean, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Yeah, bye.
Thanks for your interest.
Just before I go on to another call real quick, I think it's interesting to look at the development of the word pet.
Yeah.
Because when it starts out, it was not coined to describe an animal. It was just coined to describe another person. When you said to call someone your pet, you know, that was a term of endearment that you would apply to another person. And I guess it was sometime after that then people started to call the animals in their lives their pets.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. Before that, in the 18th century, what you find is people using the term favorite, and they'll say my favorite dog, my favorite rabbit, and that's the word they use instead of pet, and pet tended to be used to be applied to, particularly a kind of a spoiled child or a person that you had a love relationship with. So then it kind of makes a transition over to a discussion of animals.
Well, let's talk with a caller in, Champagne here, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I was just interested. This is a topic near and dear to my heart, and I finally realized you were talking about the history of America.
Yes.
And I think maybe it should be amended, the history of European America. because I haven't heard you talk about natives, and I wonder if they kept pets. And I would
question.
Like you to, you know, you've started to acknowledge that this isn't modern. The ancient Egyptians worshipped cats. I don't know if you define pet as keeping animals that you love or keeping animals that have no other usefulness. And that would be where the luxury item comes in, is to be able to afford to keep an animal that doesn't bring you any other purpose or
right.
service. But, you know, and they talked about, even the Bible talks about God creating the animals as helpers and companions for man. So
yes.
I'd say this is way before we even can recall history. So
that's absolutely true. We know from archaeology that dogs were present and living in close proximity to people at least 12,000 years ago, and some people say much longer. So they've been around for a long time. Regarding indigenous peoples or Native Americans, one of the things that you find is, well, there's a difference between North and South America. In South American indigenous groups, for example, there is a pretty considerable, in places like Mexico, a pretty considerable tradition of bird keeping. And there are small clay objects that are birds in cages. So they were part of, that clearly was a practice in South America prior to culture contact with Europeans. In the case of North America, what you find is that Native Americans had very interesting and complex relationships to dogs. Dogs were spiritual guides. Dogs were beasts of burden. Dogs were companions. They were hunters. Dogs were used as babysitters for children. So they really served a whole array of uses, and some of those kind of bled over into just dogs being present and being kind of companions, and some, I think, were clearly what we would consider pets in a modern sense, but others were workers.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I think we talked a little bit earlier about, particularly if you go back and you look at the kind of animals people had, there was a time when caged birds were extremely popular, particularly
yes.
birds that would sing. I guess that
yes.
that was the idea. And that maybe one of the things that happened to the caged songbird that made it less popular, people became less interested, was the coming of recorded music and of the radio. And that was one of the reasons that people had them, was for the pleasantness of having them sing. And
yeah.
once you could turn the radio on and have music, people didn't seem to be quite as interested in having caged birds anymore.
Yeah, I found that fascinating because birds... European Americans brought bird keeping to North America as pets, and it's we just don't think about how quiet the world was, how silent households were, that if you didn't make your own music, there was none to be had, and that women working alone in a household things were very quiet, they could be quite lonely, and I'm sort of struck by the efforts that people made to carry birds with them, even on the trek west. There's a group of wonderful photographs of soddies and pioneer homesteads in Nebraska that was taken in the 1880s by a guy named Solomon Butcher. And if you get a chance to look at a group of those photos, you'll see that there are bird cages hanging in a lot of the soddies, that people have gone to the trouble of carrying cages and bringing caged birds with them. And I think it was just because the days were so silent, it was a form of company.
Hmm. Well, let's talk again with someone else. The next caller is someone in Urbana in line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I heard you use the term pet hoarding, and I had never run across that word, that phrase, until... maybe a year or so
yeah.
now. And I have a friend who is crazy about pets. She's a general hoarder, and she always likes to have 4 dogs and, like, about 10 cats always
uh-huh.
in her household. And she is a hoarder of other, you know, of other things. And so I wondered, you know, would this constitute pet hoarding? And could you explain what pet hoarding is?
Well, pet hoarding has been a topic of interest in the animal welfare community for quite a while. And there's a veterinarian named Gary Petronik at Tufts university, at the veterinary school, who has worked on the issue of animal hoarding or pet hoarding. It has been argued that it is related to obsessive-compulsive disorder, or that it is...
hoarding is an OC problem.
Yes, that it can be an OC problem. And one of the issues that identifies true hoarding, pet hoarding, from an instance where you have somebody who just keeps an awful lot of animals...
And loves them,
has to do with the level of care that they get. What happens with hoarders is... tends to happen with hoarders is that they are eventually overwhelmed by this continuing introduction of more and more animals into the household, and the living conditions of both the people and the animals decline considerably. And periodically you'll see something in a local newspaper where a shelter group has gone into a household and to a small apartment even, and removed 20 or 30 cats or dogs in pretty miserable conditions, and that is kind of classic hoarding.
I see. Oh, no, she takes extremely good care of her pets. Extremely good care.
And I don't think it's a problem. I think that unless, you know, she's violating some kind of municipal code city gets on her.
But she has a big house, you know, and that's why she got a big house.
Well, I'm inclined to say that, you know, whether she is shading into true animal hoarding, I can't say, not seeing the case, but I would venture to say that this doesn't sound like the true animal hoarding that it has been a concern to animal welfare groups.
Okay, so animal hoarding is really a pejorative term?
It is used as a pejorative term or to identify, I wouldn't say pejorative, but to identify something that can be considered a social pathology.
Okay. Well, thank you for clearing that up.
I would rather call your friend an enthusiastic pet keeper.
She is. She just adores her. She had a diabetic cat. My goodness, she took such good care of it.
Well, that's not hoarding.
No. Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much. Well,
you're welcome.
You. Let's go to a nearby caller here. This is Belgium, not too far away from here. Hello.
Hello. How are you all today? You know, pets are really pretty much a cultural sort of thing, and it changes a lot. You go to Europe, and they allow pets in restaurants, and we would never consider that. But to carry it a little bit farther, we here in America have gone really overboard on some of our pets to the extent that it affects the way we look at other things, too. And if I might point this out, and then some people take on pets, and then they just think all wildlife needs to be, you know, treated like a pet, and take the example of white-tailed deer. Some people don't want to see you kill any white-tailed deer, even though they may be destroying a very valuable agricultural crop or whatever. It's still, they're like pets. Same way, like right now, today there was a thing on some other news channels that they're chasing a coyote around Central Park in New York City. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't mind if a dog runs wild some places, but if we really get upset with something like a coyote who might eat a dog, you know, it's kind of interesting the way we deal with these animals, you know. Things we want to preserve and some things we just want to rid ourselves of.
Well, you are really getting to the heart of some interesting questions with those comments, because first of all, what you have to tell yourself and what you need to recognize over and over again is that it is people make these decisions, and they don't necessarily make them on rational lines. They create categories, and the debate over white-tailed deer is a really good example of that, because there are now more white-tailed deer in America today than there were in the late 18th century. So you have this problem where this animal has become, in many places, a safety problem or even a public health problem, and certainly does a lot of damage to gardens and yards and things like that. Well, because my theory is that because people are not the only type of animal that they really have a day-to-day contact with is the pet, that you're right, that what happens is that becomes the sort of model for the way that we approach all kinds of animals. And while I am very concerned about animal welfare for wild animals and farm animals as well as household animals, I do think that constructing the white-tailed deer as the kind of in the same way that we kind of construct the pet is a problem. It is a real problem. And I appreciate your interest and concern in that, because it one of the things it does is it demonstrates that we don't seem to have a good way to talk about a lot of these issues. The animal's either a pet or it has no value. And in that case, you know, we seem to be lacking a good vocabulary or a good way to have some of these discussions.
And to go on with your situation where you're talking about animal hoarding, I happen to live next door to a person who has a few acres and has an enormous number of cats.
Uh-huh.
She also takes on horses and dogs and most anything else that she can carry home.
Yeah.
And the real sorry thing is about she lets the cats run free.
Yeah.
Now there are laws about dogs running free, but there are no laws about cats running free. And cats are extremely detrimental to wildlife of many sorts, not only birds, but small little mammals, anything that they can put in their mouth and kill, they're willing to do it.
Yeah.
But yet, if I try to shoot that woman's habit, I'm going to be in trouble. But yet, nobody else wants to take the responsibility for her to take care of her problem.
Right, right. Well, that's one that I really think what you want to do is, I think you need some advice on this that's kind of beyond my ability to deal with. But I do think you have a legitimate concern, and I think that one of the things that you may want to do is speak to, you know, some of the rescue groups in your area, or perhaps to the local chapter of the ASPCA, and talk about this issue, because there are sort of ways that things like that can be approached, and it sounds like you're kind of dealing with this alone. And what you might want to do is get in touch with some of these groups that can help you think about a good way to deal with this problem.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here because we just have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers. Our guest I'd like to introduce also again is Catherine Greer. She is the author of a book that looks at the history of pet keeping in America, particularly concentrating on a period of about 100 years between 1840 and 1940, during which a lot of our contemporary attitudes about pets, in fact, all of the features that we think about as being features of pet ownership really become set. And a lot of them are set back before 1900. It's a very interesting book. It has some great photographs in it. It's titled Pets in America, A History, published by the University of North Carolina Press. We'll go on and get some other folks here. Next person is in Rankin, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having Professor Greer on, because she's completing a line of inquiry that I started in historical microbiology. And thanks to you, Professor Greer, because I'm going to go out and buy your book.
Great. Oh, well, thanks.
I actually got a cold chill when you started talking about birds being kept in people's houses, because the time period that you're referring to, upper respiratory disease was rampant in America. And then if we take like a jump out of history, there is some data that suggests that mental diseases like OCD may have microbiology as its root. And so these people that are acting out, hoarding animals, it may be like a feedback loop. They may have contracted something from the animals that makes them want to hoard more animals, which, of course, you know, just goes around in a circle. I love this line of inquiry that you've opened up to me. I'm curious, in your book, and then I'll hang up, do you talk about the health impacts of animals as pets?
I do, probably not exactly in the same line that you, the line that your interest is following, but I do discuss that because one of the things that in the progressive era, in the early 20th century, as part of efforts to improve urban sanitation, the presence of animals in cities in general becomes a topic of real concern. And you have the first efforts to control feral cats, for example, in significant numbers, because cats had played a really important role in the urban ecology by being the single best way to attack the problem of rats and mice in communities. But as sanitation improved, they lost their ecological niche in communities. And one of the things that you have to sort of think about when you're looking at communities in the 19th century is that they were very much multi-species communities. and that animals played an important role and actually could play a positive role in public health in the case of these cats in the early 20th century. When they lost their niche, they then became a problem for animal welfare organizations, and there are campaigns in the early 20th century where hundreds of thousands of cats are gathered up and killed because they no longer have a place in this urban ecology.
Were there times when in the past when people raised concerns about whether people having living with animals in their homes, cats, dogs, birds, whether ever was some sort of potential health threat? The idea was, oh, the animals could be vectors of disease.
Right. The first time that you really start to see that is at the end of the 19th century, when the germ theory, which was introduced in the 1880s, is popularized. And some household advisors start to argue that the presence of animals in the household is another disease vector, and that conscientious mothers in particular should be very concerned about keeping canaries and fish and all these kinds of creatures in their households. The flip side of that is that the pet industry went on the, or the pet, I shouldn't say the pet industry at that point, but pet stores went on the offensive and said, wait a minute. In fact, when you keep an animal and you keep it healthy and well, you have to have a clean environment. A bird can't thrive in a dirty cage in a house that doesn't get sunlight and fresh air. So they argued that the activity of keeping pets actually had a positive health benefit. Then you also start to see by the late 19th century what had been a moral discussion about pets teaching children kindness becomes a broader discussion about human emotions and human development. And so it's argued that from a modern developmental standpoint and a standpoint of emotional health, that pets are important not only for children but also for adults, especially adults who are alone.
Let's take at least one more call here. Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Do you know how the name Polly came into use for parrots?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Because I had to find out, because I ran into so many Pollys in my research. And one of the things that it comes from is that Polly, like the name Tom that appeared for male cats, were sort of generic names that were used for working-class servant girls. They were called Pollys and Mollys. Oh. And so for some reason, the notion of Polly, the parrot, Polly became a name for pet parrots. One of the things may have been that sailors, who were some of the early people who kept parrots and brought them back to cities, named them after girls, is one of the things that may have happened. And they treated all parrots as if they were female.
And literature, sometimes they say Paul.
Yes, a Paul parrot.
Yeah.
But they also call girls Paul. You'll find a servant girl. You'll find servant girls in literature described as being called Polly or Paul.
I see.
That's where it came from.
Thank you.
All right.
Welcome.
Thank you. We're coming down to the point here. We have just a couple of minutes left, and people, there's more here in this book than we have touched on. And again, I think I found it interesting. I think that people might want to take a look at it. To come now to the present, and you, I know it says here on the dust jacket that you have in your family two cats and two dogs.
Yeah.
So you're a person who lives with animals.
And
right at the conclusion of the book, you said that what all this, of course, leads you to is to start thinking about pets in modern America. Do you see anything substantially changing, or is this the sort of kind of things that we've been talking about and have been continuities for a long time likely to stay with us?
I think that I do see a lot of continuities. I will say that it's clear that after the World War II period, that pet keeping there was sort of been described as an explosion of pet keeping, and I don't know whether we really have the figures to support that or whether because good statistics really weren't kept until the 1960s. But it's clear that more and more households are involved with animals and keeping different kinds of animals. There are trends that are interesting, and we don't really know how they're going to shake out yet. One is the debate over purebred dogs, which is getting pretty passionate in a lot of places about whether it's ethical to breed purebred dogs, whether you should be only adopting mutts, you know, as well as the discussion of puppy mills and how purebred dogs, how people attain purebred dogs. So that's a discussion that's going on. And another discussion that's going on is the debate about whether certain kinds of birds and reptiles are appropriate pets. The Humane Society of the United States, for example, says, no, they're not. You really shouldn't be keeping these animals. But, in fact, reptiles are becoming more and more popular, and some of them, increasing numbers of them, are captive bred. So the question becomes, if you're not pulling them out of their environment, if you're not having a negative impact on the Central American ecology, for example, what's wrong with keeping them, right, with if you're taking good care of them? I don't happen to be a snake lover myself, but it's hard for me to say no. If you're a good steward of your pet snake, it's hard for me to say that you really shouldn't have it if you have obtained it in a legal way and it has been captive bred. So there's a lot of discussion right now about which kinds of animals are appropriate, as well as issues over breeding and things like that.
Well, there we must leave it because we've used our time. The book, again, is Pets in America, A History. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press by our guest, Catherine Greer. She's professor of material culture studies at Winterthur Program in Early American Culture at the Winterthur Museum and Garden and Library and the University of Delaware. You might also want to look at her other book, Culture and Comfort, Parlor Making and Middle Class Identity, 1850 to 1930.
Well,
and,
thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
It's been a really interesting hour, and I appreciate your interest in my project.
Very good. Well, I enjoyed it very much. Take care. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archive. Other Focus interviews, along with shows from the Afternoon Magazine, in fact, all of our local production, is available for you to listen to anytime you like. It's at WILL.UIUC.EDU. In hour number two, we'll have another show from the Archive, so we hope that you will stay with us. Coming up in just a moment, we'll have news, so please stay tuned.
WILL programming is made possible in part by Illinois American Water. The employees of Illinois American Water are proud to serve Champaign County and are focused on being a good steward of the Mahomet Aquifer by funding research to help protect and preserve this valuable water source for future generations. Support for WILL comes from World Gourmet Foods, now celebrating their first anniversary on Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington. World Gourmet features daily tasting, and on Saturday, April 14th, an extended tasting of more than 200 items, including specialty cheeses, rare and origin-protected extra virgin olive oils, aged balsamic vinegar, and more, on the web at worldgourmetfoods.com. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade in the corn pit. Futures are lower earlier today on speculative long liquidation, as well as a drop in outside markets, including the gold market. Early weakness in the crude oil market also has lent some pressure this morning, but corn futures are finding some underlying support from commercial buying and news overnight that South Korea purchased 275,000 tons of U.S. corn. But it's been a very slow kind of morning. On